In our morning classes, we're discussing the Ajamila story, and we ended as far as our recollection go, we were discussing in the car on the way here. We ended with chapter 2, and we're just beginning chapter 3. So we're just beginning the Yamadutas approaching Yamaraj for an explanation of what happened. Does anybody remember differently? What were the last points that we covered? See if we just let them churn there. Memories a little bit. What did we discuss? That's way back. That's way back in the very beginning. To illustrate that, the story was told, the story of Ajamila. And Ajamila became fallen. And at the time of death, he called for his son. And then, so the Vishnudutas came while the Yamadutas were there and they had some discussion. What was the nature of that discussion? You're already in chapter 3. Well, that answer is where we're going right now. There was a discussion between the Vishnudutas and the Yamadutas. What is Dharma? What are the principles of punishment for violation of Dharma? What is the method of determining who is punishable? And are all fruitive workers, important question, are all fruitive workers punishable or only some? So then the Yamaduta Uchuhu, what did they say? Yamadutas said, what is Dharma is
final power of spiritual authority.
Yeah. The Vedas are directly manifested from the Supreme Lord, therefore they're non-different than the Supreme Lord, and within the Vedas are the codes of proper conduct. The Dharma is to follow the Vedas, the codes of proper conduct. And other than that, it's a Dharma. Then what else did they say? The very next thing is important. The sequence is important. There's a relationship between the Vedas and the Supreme Lord. Then there's a relationship between living entities and the Supreme Lord. What is that relationship?
Master.
Huh?
Supreme Lord is master and living entities.
What did, yes, that's true. What did he say? Or what did they say? It connects to the Vedas. Although the Supreme Lord is aloof, He's in a spiritual world, has nothing to do with this material world. However, under his direction, the three modes of material nature act. Those three modes of material nature award bodies to living entities, and according to the bodies, then there's designations, varnas and ashrams. According to those varnas and ashrams, there's various duties. And those who submit to the Vedas are regulated by medium of those duties. And in this way, he is the cause of all causes. Although he's aloof, he is situated in the spiritual world, he has a relationship with the living entities through the medium of Dharma. Or living entities have a relationship with him through the medium of Dharma. And those that act outside of that, that's adharma, they're punishable. Then what did the Yamadutas say? He said a lot of things.
Huh?
That's at the very end. They're building a case before the judge.
They gave a historical account of a Ajama.
Right. There's two main categories of things that they did. They explained more in detail about the system of determining who is punishable and who is not punishable. They explained that you, Vishnudutas, you're free from any of this responsibility. But other living entities, as long as they have a material body and are in the bodily conception, they're impelled into fruitive work. And as long as they do fruitive work, they gave the answer, then they're bound to the reactions of that work. And because they're implicated in the modes of nature, even they do primarily good things, also the other modes of nature have their influence, and therefore some deviations will be there, and therefore all living entities engaged in fruitive work are punishable. Answered that last question. Are all living entities engaged in fruitive work punishable? Yes. Then they had a little Samkhya section. They broke it down into the soul, this 16 subtle elements, the mind, the knowledge acquiring senses, the working senses, the sense objects, and the whole interaction, how the whole system of samsara works, how they become implicated through the medium of the material energy, although their spirit soul, they're implicated by these laws. They explained that there's 13 different witnesses, foremost of them being super soul, and then a list of others, the sun, the moon, the stars, the air, the sky, the earth, fire, so many, and according to the testimony of those witnesses, the verdict is given. And then they said that Yamaraj is very special. How is it that they said Yamaraj is very special in determining the dharma and the adharma of the living entity?
He's omniscient.
Yeah. He's omniscient. He's omniscient in this way. He has a special password. to Super Soul's information. Computer lingo. Super Soul imparts an understanding to him. He's empowered by the Super Soul to know the details of everyone's activities, because the Super Soul knows the details. And Yamaraj has that service, so he's given that password. He knows. It's as if Yamaraj is situated in the heart of every living entity. So he knows. And then an outline of, so that those are principles. The principles were applied. Here's a Jamil's life. Sinful this and this and this and this. Guilty. Here's the principles applied to the person. Guilty. And he didn't atone. Punishable. And then, that was the end of chapter 1. Then chapter 2 is the Vishnudutta's reply. And what did the Vishnudutta say? I'm sorry, I was reading this note. Could you please say it again? Yeah. That's the main message that they gave. What did they say at the very beginning? It's also very important. At the very beginning, we've heard from you, and our verdict about your qualification to represent Yamaraj is because, why? The duty of someone who is taking responsibility for others, it's their duty to protect them. And you want to punish someone who should be protected. What a horrible circumstance. What are the citizens in a kingdom to do if the king exercises authority in that abusive way? I gave the example just like a child takes shelter of a parent, lays their head in the lap of the parent hurts them. Where's their shelter? What a circumstance. It's your duty to know these principles of Dharma. You don't know. And then they explain the principle that they didn't know, which you addressed. Yes, it's true. So they're explaining Namabhas. They're explaining at the very end of chapter 2. Did we get to that? The Jamila, the various parties go away and the Jamila assesses. Close call. Did we cover that? No. Okay. At the very end, so when the Vishnudutas finish their speech, the Yamadutas, they're fried. They're completely flustered. So they just leave. That the ropes that they have are cut and they're dismissed. Take a hike, guys, get out of here. So they go whimpering back to Yamaraj. What happened? And then a Jamila. Close call. And he wants to express his appreciation of the whole thing that just happened. And the Vishnudutas want him to glorify the Supreme Lord, not to glorify them. So they disappear. And he's left alone. And he starts to speak. And the first thing he speaks, well, the statement is made that he has just heard three main things. One of them is principles of religion pertaining to the modes of nature. That's what the Yamadutas discussed. The Vishnudutas discussed the principles of religion that are free from the influence of the modes of nature. Sanatan Dharma or Bhagavat Dharma. The glories of the holy name specifically, but principles that do not pertain to actions and interactions and counteractions and permutations and combinations of the modes of nature. Transcendental principles of religion. Second point that he heard. And the third is directly the glorification of the name, fame, qualities, pastimes, and the personality of Godhead. He just heard a wonderful Bhagavatam class with rapt attention. So that's primarily what the Vishnudutas are discussing. Principles that the Yamadutas weren't tuned into that brought them to the point of being defeated by the Vishnudutas. They superseded the lower principles by higher principles. The Vishnudutas conceded that yes, that Jamila was very sinful. And yes, when he called for his son Narayan, he was not thinking Lord Narayan. Those are both true. He was involved in the modes of material nature. He had neglected his religious principles. He didn't do the worldly prayaschitta. He did call the name of Narayan thinking about his son, but that calling of Narayan, the four syllables were there. And those four syllables are absolute. Narayana. And even in that kind of Abbas chanting, that is sufficient to nullify the reactions, not only for the sins he did in his life as a Jamila, but for hundreds and thousands and millions of lifetimes. Now there's some analysis that it wasn't offensive because if Ajamila had been thinking that although I'm sinful, I've got this holy name, I've got special wild card, and I'll just chant the holy name by calling my son, and those sinful activities will be neutralized. And I can go on sinning and just call Narayan all day long and sinning all day long. That would have been offensive. Naam aparad. He was not thinking like that. Although he was sinful, although he neglected his brahminical duties, although he did so many bad, I mean, reprehensible things. It was not Shudhanam, but it was not Namaparad. That Namavas chanting makes him free from all reactions. Therefore, he's not punishable, although he was engaged in fruitive activity and adverse fruitive activity. You're wrong. Not that all fruitive workers are punishable. And therefore, leave this place with breaking these ropes. And they left. And then the Vishnudutas left, and Ajamila is left alone to contemplate his situation. His first response was that great feelings of humility overwhelmed him. He recounted his wrongdoings. And he did even a better job of recounting his wrongdoings than the Yamadutas had done. I just abandoned my faithful wife. Very, very simple. My parents were old, and they were dependent upon me. I was the only son. And I just neglected them. And they suffered terribly. And whatever wealth I had, I did not use it for the Lord. I used it for the grossest kinds of sense gratification. I begot children in the womb of a low-class woman. I ate the food of a low-class person. Prabhupada has a very strong purport in that regard. Something that all of you can bear in mind as you continue on in your life. Right now, nice situation, nice association, plenty of prasadam prepared very carefully by nicely trained devotees offered to the Lord. Prasadam. And then when you move on to your next situation, don't eat food that's prepared by non-devotees. Even if it's vegetarian. Don't eat food that's prepared by them. The reason is, one's consciousness becomes polluted. Because consciousness is transmitted through the act of cooking. Did I go into this at all when I was here before? No? Yes, I did.
Some portions of them.
This
part.
Okay.
The other side should be part. This
one. Okay. So, he didn't stop there. Sometimes devotees will just stop there and keep dwelling and lamenting and I'm so fallen, woe is me, singing the blues, ooh, 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 just feeling bad for themselves. He didn't stop there. He had been very sinful, far more than, the totality of what he did was, it'll surpass anything that we could even try to do, even think to do. So what he did was, he realized that he received great mercy. And so then he made very firm determination. His reactions had been cleared, and he made firm determination that I am going to take full opportunity of the remaining breaths I have in life and fix my consciousness morning till night in pure devotion. He went for the rectification program. He left that place, he went to Haridwar, and took shelter in the Vishnu temple. He was 78 years old. I guess they had some facility for elder people to stay and finish their lives. And he completely absorbed himself in devotion to Lord Vishnu. This is our BBT printed a book describing this story, and they call it The Second Chance, or A Second Chance. This was his second chance. He had a chance in his youth. He really messed up. But there's the residual effect of his youth was that he called his son Narayan, and so he had some Abbas Bhakti. Now he went for Shuddha Bhakti. second chance. We may not get a second chance. Ajamil got a second chance. And he perfected his life. And the end of the chapter describes that a vimana from Vaikuntha came to Haridwar when it was time for him to leave his body. And he left his body. In his spiritual body, he got on the vimana back to Vaikuntha. Four Vishnu dutas, four agents of Lord Vishnu were there. Doesn't say it was the same ones, but quite a different ending. He wasn't eligible to go back to Godhead from his Abbas Bhakti, but from Shuddha Bhakti he was eligible. In Harinam Chintamani, this Abbas Namabhas chanting entitles one to become free from the actions of sins and achieve liberation. But love of God must come from offenseless chanting the Shuddha Nam. So he came to that stage. The love of God had awakened. Back home, back to Godhead. So there's hope for all of us. I just received a letter from someone who took up Krishna consciousness later in their life, and they're lamenting so many years of fruitive activity I just wasted. So I feel I should be punished. They were using that exact language. I feel I should be punished. I should have many lifetimes of just very intently engaging myself in devotional service to make up for or to pay for that foolishness. I wrote a letter in reply. What you should fix your consciousness on is not determining what Lord Vishnu should or shouldn't do with you. You fix your consciousness on becoming purified. You fix your consciousness like a Jamil. From this point forward, my life is yours. And you can do with me what you like. Let me just somehow please you by my words, by my actions, by my thoughts. Let this life be an offering just to please you. Let my existence become purified in that way. You can use me as an instrument if you like. You can neglect me if you like. You can embrace me if you like. Whatever you like. Just like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu prayed. Be in that consciousness. Not where will I go after this body consciousness. Although it's good, Prabhupada indicated, if we're not at such an advanced stage of Krishna consciousness, particularly in the preliminary stages, the earlier stages of devotion, it's good to aspire to be with Krishna. We can't imitate Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's consciousness. We should want to be with Krishna. We should want to not linger and loiter in this material world. We should want to be with Krishna. But when our consciousness becomes more elevated, we can realize that we can be with Krishna anywhere. If we're in pure consciousness or offenseless consciousness of Krishna. So, end of chapter 2, beginning of chapter 3. Now, what time? Some have to go for class this morning, 7:30. We have to leave here at 7:30. Is that the cutoff time? Yes? Okay. So, chapter 3 begins with the Yamadutas reaching the abode of Yamaraj and explaining what happened. They gave the sequence of events. Actually, the first thing that happens is Maharaj Parikshit churns the nectar. What happened when the Yamadutas returned? What did they say? What did Yamaraj say? How was it concluded? Please tell. So he adds that it's never been heard of before, Maharaj Parikshit says. It's never been heard of that the Yamadutas, the representatives of the Lord of Death, are foiled. This is most astonishing. Please describe in detail. So, the Yamadutas are, well, they're in a kind of a frisky, agitated state of mind. They're speaking not in the most submissive manner, because they feel that they've been sent on a mission and they were let down. So here's what they say. Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur says that the Yamadutas were so disappointed that they asked their master these questions almost in great anger. Furthermore, because the Yamadutas had been defeated and their master could not protect them, they were inclined to say that there was no need to serve such a master. If a servant cannot carry out the orders of his master without being defeated, what is the use of serving such a powerless master? They were fried. So they asked a series of questions. One of them was, how many controllers or rulers are there in this material world, O dear Lord? This discussion is, if you're asked in the future, one of the classic questions. I thought in Hinduism there's the notion that there's many gods. Why do you teach about one God? Well, the same dialogue is taking place between the Yamadutas and the Vishnu and Yamaraj. Are there many controllers, or is there one controller? And then they ask the same, almost the same question again, only slightly differently. They say, how many causes are responsible for manifesting the various results of activities performed under the three modes of material nature? They're still down in this religious principles according to the modes of material nature. And who's the enforcer of those laws of material nature? Are there multiple enforcers? And then they reason very, very perceptively. Listen to this. If in this universe there are many rulers and justices who disagree about punishment and reward, their contradictory actions will neutralize each other and no one will be punished or rewarded. Or else, if their contradictory acts fail to neutralize each other, everyone will be both punished and rewarded. And neither seems to be right. So therefore, inductively, We reason there must be a supreme controller. Because otherwise the system of justice is injustice. Or no justice. People that should be punished get rewarded. People that should be rewarded get punished. Or nothing happens. Or there's just a big disagreement, chaos. So there must be one justice above all justices. There must be one controller above all controllers. And we thought that was you. Because you're infallible. You know everything. We've never been stopped before. You're always right. What happened? Yeah, just as one central emperor controls different departmental rulers, there must be one supreme controller to guide all judges. The supreme judge must be one, not many. It was our understanding that you are that supreme judge, and that you have jurisdiction even over the demigods. Because what do the demigods do? They supply. But on what basis do they supply or not supply? Their thinking was you. Because you determine, you're the judge, you determine justice, and then they administer the justice. The Justice Department, in their estimation, is above the Administrative Department. Like a Brahminical function is above a Kshatriya function. The Kshatriyas administer according to the codes of Dharma. And the understanding of what is Dharma is determined by, of course, the Kshatriyas need to know, but the Brahmanas are the reservoir of that knowledge. So that was the system that we thought was going on. But now we see that the punishment ordained under your authority is no longer effective, since your order has been transgressed by four wonderful and perfect persons. We were bringing the most sinful Ajamila toward the hellish planets following your order when these beautiful persons from Siddhaloka forcibly cut the knots of the ropes with which we were arresting him. As soon as the sinful Ajamil uttered the name Narayana, these four beautiful men immediately arrived and reassured him, saying, "Do not fear, do not fear. Masuchaha." What's the verse? Moksha Yashami Masuchaha. We wish to know about them from your lordships. If you think that we are able to understand them, apparently their tone simmered down a little bit, becoming a little more submissive. If you feel that we're qualified to understand who these people were and what happened, please explain. So, Yamaraj is one of the 12 Mahajans. Yamaraj is the father of Yudhisthira Maharaj, who is also called Dharmaraj. And in the Mahabharata, on a couple of occasions, in disguise, Yamaraj wanted to test the religious principles of his son. And one of those circumstances was when the Pandavas were in the forest and experiencing extreme thirst, and there was a lake on the other side of, you know this narration, One by one, the Pandavas went, and they heard a voice saying, before you drink the water, you must answer my questions. We're the Pandavas. We're thirsty. We'll drink water. We'll answer your questions later. And one by one, they drank the water and apparently died. One by one, and find the remaining was Yudhisthira. So he went over this mountain and saw all his dead brothers and saw the lake and heard the voice. He didn't drink water. Not just because he saw his dead brothers, but he was who he was. He was a perfectly pious person. And so this yaksha appeared, very fierce-looking, fearful-looking entity. It was his father in disguise. His father disclosed later. He wanted to test his religious principles. So he asked him many questions, and there's a wonderful dialogue, and it's worth studying. But one of those questions in the sequence was, religious principles are very, very complex. And to understand how one should act in different circumstances is sometimes very, very difficult. We find those circumstances. Here's a principle, and here's a principle, and here's a principle. And they're all principles, and it's something that we should follow. But if we do this, we can't do that, or if we do that, we'll contradict this. And so how do you adjust these things? How do you understand what is to be done and what is not to be done in complex circumstances of real life? We face it all the time. And that's the question posed by the yaksha. And Yudhisthira replies, it's true what you say. It's a very, very complex arrangement. Therefore, there's only one solution, and that is to follow the path chalked out by the Mahajans. So Prabhupada quotes this many times in his lectures in Bhagavad Gita. It's there several times. Mahajano yena katha sapanta. Just like dharmam sakshat bhagavat pranitam. These are outstanding principles. The codes of dharma, it's given by God. But how do we understand those codes of dharma? Through the medium of the Mahajans. It's very, very standard understanding. But we often neglect it because we think we're so smart or something or something or something. We lose that position of submissiveness to great authorities. Yamaraj is one of those great authorities. He is one of the 12 Mahajans identified in this chapter 3. So he gives a very perfect answer. And the Yamadutas become pacified. First of all, when here's their description of the whole situation, he's very pleased. He's very pleased with them primarily because they chanted the name Narayana. So he knows what that means, even though they didn't know what that means. They weren't thinking as they were saying Narayana, our worshipable Lord, right? It was something in the Abbas category also. Jamil, he said Narayan, and Vishnu, these personalities came as soon as he said Narayan, and it was Abbas. So Yamaraj says, my dear servants, you accepted me as the Supreme, but factually, I am not. Above me and above all other demigods, including Indra and Chandra, is the one Supreme Master and Controller. The partial manifestations of His personality are Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. Partial manifestations. who are in charge of the creation, maintenance, and annihilation of this universe. He is like two threads that form the length and breadth of a woven cloth. So, here's a woven cloth. Can you see the two threads? But is not this woven cloth nothing but two threads? That's what it is. But we don't see the two threads. We see the cloth. He is those two woven threads. It's described in more detail in the purport. That for the material world, when we were in Navadvip, Parikram, we visited the residence of Advaita Acharya in Navadvip Dham, in Mayapur, and also in Shantipur. He was a wealthy Brahmin. He had two residences. And the place in Shantipur was very big. Bigger than the structure that's there now. Very, very, very big. In his Leela, he was an aristocratic, highly learned, most respected Brahmana, Vaishnava. He's called Advaita because he's one of these two threads. According to Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's two causal principles for material creation. One of them is called the efficient cause, and the other is called the material cause. The efficient cause, or sometimes called remote cause, is remote. Has nothing, it is just the seeds of the universe generate from the body of Mahavishnu, described in detail in Brahma Samhita. So Mahavishnu, he is the efficient cause. And then another of one of these threads that makes the material world is he who is an expansion of Mahavishnu, who oversees the conglomerating, Bhaktisiddhanta uses that word, the mixing of the seed of the universe and the universal elements. That second principle is called Advaita. So, I don't know if this is the kind of cloth. Some cloths, you can pull a thread, just keep pulling the thread and pulling the thread and pulling the thread, and after some time you don't have any fabric anymore, just have a pile of thread, because that's all the fabric is thread woven in a certain pattern. When woven, it's so nicely woven that you don't even notice. It's just fabric. Similarly, many people look at this material world, they don't see the Supreme Lord. They just see material ingredients put together in very interesting combinations, which some of which they like and is a means of enjoyment, some of which they don't like and they try to avoid or rearrange. It's a playground for children, for enjoying or suffering. Not seeing the hand of the Supreme Lord. The atheist sees the material world as an opportunity for enjoyment or suffering. And what Yamaraj is doing, because he's a Vaishnav, he's showing this is actually the Supreme Lord. The Sanskrit terms are Ottam and Protam. He said that the Lord is actually, he is the being the both the principles, both causal principles, he's the cause of all causes. And I'm just part of the show, I'm part of the fabric. He finishes the verse, and I'll finish the class. by saying, like a bull is controlled by putting a rope or a ring through his nose, and you pull a little on the rope tied to the ring, and this big lumbering animal moves. You pull the other way, he moves the other way. Pull back, he stops. He'll go forward. You control something very, very strong and powerful by this sensitive part of his body, his sensitive nose. So the human beings are also controlled by remote control, by the Supreme Lord, through the agency of the principles of Dharma. We're connected to the Supreme Lord. We're obedient servants of the Supreme Lord, at least to a certain degree, by following the codes of Dharma. I say to a certain degree is because our consciousness may be a little bit animal-like. We may not be thinking, I want to please the Supreme Lord. We may be just thinking, I don't want the pain, so I'll follow this way and follow that way. I don't want to suffer. Thinking selfishly instead of devotionally. The higher principle is to think devotionally. So Yamaraj is responding that I'm part of the fabric and the Supreme Lord is the cause of the fabric. And as the cause of the fabric, we're all submissive to Him, myself included. So he's answered the first of the Yamadutta's questions. Is there one Supreme or are there many? And then there's implications to that question which he's going to deal with tomorrow morning. It's 7:22. So see if there's any discussion.
Compared to the Supreme Lord, or the
threat
is coming from the Supreme Lord?
Achintya Veda, Aveda, Tattva. He's the causal principle, but the causal principle. Both. And Yamaraj is saying he's part of the effect. As a servant, it appears that he's the cause. I'm not the cause. I'm the servant. I'm the caused.
Thank you very much for explaining the point about how they assert the name of Narayana, more or less, in Pratyabhas. That was more like a comment or a question.
Okay.
Sometimes, even amongst devotees, we sometimes say Hare Krishna or something.
Yeah. Yeah. We do. We're for the most part, we're on different gradations of the Abbas platform. Talking about and glorifying the Shuddha platform, but actually functioning on the Abbas platform, or the intermediate stage of bhakti. In differing degrees, contemplating the Shuddha platform of bhakti. Sometimes not. Sometimes more. Go ahead. Question? No. Just tapping your... Okay. Thank you. We should want to be with Krishna. Well, there's the avoiding the negative and achieving the positive. There's this, which you won't be subjected to. And there's that, which is very desirable. So because we're in this stage of identifying with duality, it's good to recognize the superior position. And aspiring like that is unavoidable to see with some kind of duality. When our consciousness comes to an absolute plane of consciousness, there is no longer duality. Like Prahlad Maharaj, like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, like anyone who is in a stage of pure consciousness, wherever, King Chitraketu, wherever. As long as I can be engaged in your service and remember you, that's a higher stage. Yeah.
Is that an analogy? You hear an analogy of the Supreme Lord and the friend of the family.
Yeah.
And the demigod being born out. Now, some people could understand that the threat of the Supreme Lord has to be worshipped. And there are some people who could see only the fabric and the design.
That's right.
And is it to be blamed that they see only that?
No.
And
It's not blamed, but it should not be blamed, but it should be pointed out.
Are they also on some platform of faith?
No. They're on some platform of religiosity. We're making it for terminology's sake. Just like what the Vishnu, what the Yamadutas spoke about was religiosity, and they spoke nicely, very nicely. What they didn't understand was transcendence, or even abhas bhakti, how it can supersede and neutralize as the perfect form of atonement. They were saying they didn't do any atonement, punishable. They did do the best kind of atonement, but they were unable to understand. The Yamadutas were unable to understand that. So, the term bhakti applies for the personality of Godhead. The term bhakti does not apply for others, including demigods and exalted beings and the pious beings. It's an inappropriate use of the term. Yaji is appropriate. Worship. The point that I'm making is discussed in many places, but one easily accessible place is the last purport of chapter 6, Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada explains this word bhaj is appropriate for the personality of Godhead, not for others. It's exclusive. Although it's exclusive, when you worship, when you render devotional service to the personality of Godhead, because the demigods and all living entities are connected, they're all receiving benefit. Like putting water on the root of the tree, those putting food in the stomach. That which is meant for worship of the demigods is accomplished by devotion to the personality of Godhead, not conversely. If I worship the demigods automatically and performing bhakti, not so. Clear? It's a sensitive point for some people because of certain I mean, was unless someone was brought up in a Vaishnava tradition, then some kind of piety is likely to be there in the background, and some kind of worship of some kind that goes along with that piety. And so this issue is an important issue to not only intellectually understand, but also feelingly relate with. Very important. Yeah. It's not just an intellectual adjustment. There are certain conceptions that need to be addressed. It's not that it doesn't begin and end there. Our feelings should match with that these Vaishnava conceptions are. There's never any appeal to disregard, disrespect the demigods or worshippers of demigods. Aviti Purvakam, Krishna says, they're just doing what they're doing with not proper knowledge. And their knowledge becomes covered because of their strong material desires. They can't, even we could have this discussion, they couldn't hear because they have strong material desires and strong conceptions that support those desires. It's a whole frame. While that's true, so our mood should not be, what was the word that you used? Blamed. It's not our business. But making Krishna's words clear, clearly understandable, that we should do. We respect and educate. Someone, yes, right behind you, you had a question.
About the contradictory principles.
Hmm. Yeah.
When should I distinguish this mercy of Krishna, like encouraging everybody to chant? But one of the offenses is to describe the glories of the Holy Devotee for this mercy.
Yeah.
So to what extent?
Okay, that's a nice question. A very simple answer is, I'll just take the example Yadyaracharati Shrestas. The example that Prabhupada gave us is we can encourage people chant and be happy. The intricacies are not immediately presented. Chant and be happy. Chant and your life will be sublime. Chant and you've become free from material distress. And then, when involved in chanting, that's what they experience. They don't understand the intricacies. When someone is sincere to inquire into the nature, not in a challenging or where they feel that they're being challenged, like confronted. So not in a confrontational mood from either side, but when there's sincere inquiry, this can be, these many things can be explained. Okay. Ajamila, how did Ajamila regret? How did he regret? Mumbling. Our radar isn't picking up your message. Try again. Sonar either. How to properly regret? That's your question. Well, I can think of at least three different parts. The final part I've already emphasized, and that is move on. That's proper regret is don't dwell there. I think that's the biggest mistake when people enter into the area of regret. They stay there and start to stagnate, and they just surrender to the mode of ignorance and lament and become lethargic and can't do anything and rot. So move on. That's the most important principle. But it should be done for the sake of purification, not for the sake of just, you know, putting yourself at the center. You see, that's another mistake that people make. Me, 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 me. I'm the most fallen. It's for purification. And you're not having a contest for someone else who can berate themselves more, myself or the next person. My qualification is I can berate myself more. I win. You're not in competition. Purification. Same point, purification. And another point is denial. If I want to engage in proper regret, I should be ready to regret across the board. But I find some persons are willing to regret something over here, but they're just stubborn. They won't even acknowledge something that's maybe even more important. Just got through dealing with somebody like that. Maharaj, I'm so fallen. But you know, the real problem is over here. Oh. They were not so willing to be regretful about that one because they didn't want to even recognize that one. So proper regret is don't be in denial about things that need to be rectified. Because often those are the things that are holding us back, more so than the things that we're willing to cleanse. Those are three points that come to mind. In all three, a very powerful and beneficial component is sadhu sangha. Because sadhu sangha can help us in all three. We can hold ourselves accountable before some sadhu that can tell us this is an area that you need to also rectify and feel some regret for. Recognize and feel some regret for. This is an area, you know, now you're getting into a mode of just overly blaming yourself and overly putting yourself down and overly, you know, it's kind of like a false humility. And the sadhu sangha can also tell you, very good, now move forward. Uplifting, sadhu sangha. It's very, very helpful in the regret department. Hold yourself accountable to a sadhu. My dear Prabhu, you give me some advice, and not only I'll say thank you, but I'll do it. Little detail. Nice question. Anything else? What happened to those that have class and have to go are free to do so? Those that can stay are free to stay. So you don't feel like you're disturbing our class if you need to go. Any remaining questions? Or are we done? Okay.
I'm approaching the holy man. How to approach the holy man?
While approaching the holy name, how to... Not one of the how-to questions. How to remain humble? That's your question? Well, much like a jhamiel, take a look at reality. What is my situation? Take stock of your real life situation. How strong is my attraction for the holy name? How much in feelings of genuine devotion for the Supreme Lord is awakened in my heart? How tall is the mountain of pride and other undesirable things that are there? Take stock in a inventory of one's real qualifications or lack of qualifications. How tiny my existence really is, and how much I'm utterly dependent upon some descending mercy coming. And Krishna has made himself immediately, personally available. So mercifully, he's made himself available through his holy name. Then I can call out great humility. One can also think of great devotees of the Lord who exemplify that quality of humility. Invoke remembrance of that quality of humility. It's humbling to recognize how distant we are from that standard of humility. It's humbling and inspiring. Another thing is how, aside from the time that you're spending actually chanting, the rest of the time that you spend when you're doing other duties, you can cultivate humility in those other duties so that when you approach the holy name, you're already in a state of humility. Anything else? Yes, yeah.
Maharaj, when Yudhishthira Maharaj answers Maharaj and Arjuna, this may be very easy for a personality who already knows the Shastra and who have deeply studied that, they know the nuances of how the Mahajans go for the Shastra and so on. But for, you know, people like us, it seems that our Shastric base and our understandings of, even if we understand the Shastra in this information-like manner, the depth of how the Mahajans have applied that, you know, it's not so clear many times.
Yeah. Well, therefore, someone that's in that position needs in a humble way to recognize that's my position, at least in principle. I'm this, and they're not this, they're that. Therefore, I should approach them. And if, at least in principle, in course of time, as I read the scripture, and just like here, here's one of the Mahajans speaking. Now, my position is, I've grown up with such and such and such and such experience of piety, and with that piety some worship, and it's in the background. And I don't know clearly Mahajans, and but here's one speaking. It can clear one's anxieties about that issue if I'm just in principle submissive. And then as I become a little more conversant and a little more advanced and a little more clear, a little more purified, I can start more deeply appreciating the innuendos of that statement, Mahajana Yena Katasa Panta. But at least, if I, so I've heard it, it's been explained, it's a principle, I can take shelter of that principle with faith. And that will help me come to this stage where not only I'm reading so many things, but there's so many people reading so many things that they don't have that principle, Mahajana Yena Katasa Panta. They're off on their own trip, interpreting this way, that way, this means this, this implies that, and confusing themselves and anybody that comes near them. No surrender, no principle, speculation, no qualification, no heart transformation. So, at whatever stage, we apply the principle to our capacity, become uplifted. Birds singing in our window. Okay. So we'll end there. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada.